And we are live, and for some of you that will be tuning in, you are listening to me live again today. I just got off of a two-hour live stream with Nicole Sauce and John Willis of Living Free in Tennessee for Nicole and SOE Tactical Gear for John. That live stream, if you're interested and haven't seen it yet, is now archived and on my YouTube channel and on my other video platforms as well. But that's not what we're doing today. It's kind of a roundtable discussion. Today we're talking about flat top griddle cooking like a pro. And I want to say something out of the gate here that doesn't even matter if you're listening to the audio podcast, but it will matter if you're listening in the future on YouTube and you don't know me and you don't know the Survival Podcast and all. This is a podcast. So if you were looking for griddle stuff and you think you're going to see like a show on how to cook on a griddle with like active cooking, like, you know, like the cooking channel on YouTube, that's not what today is. And I just wanted to be honest about that because I've been looking for stuff on YouTube before and been like, where is the thing that I want to see? So I just want to be straight up. We're going to talk about a lot of cool shit today, though. And so if that's what you were looking for, but you just want to be a better cook, whether it's flat top griddle or better cook in general, this might be worth hanging out for. Even if that wasn't initially what you thought when you found this video, if you're watching again the video segment, we're going to talk about why we use griddles, gas versus electric. We're going to talk about a bunch on accessories. I'm going to give you, what is it, 6 recipes or 7 recipes? And really, it's more not like detailed recipes, more like ideas and ways to cook. The one I'm going to lead off when I get to the recipe section alone is worth the price of admission since it's free, but it would be worth it probably for some money because the recipe I'm going to give you is money. And I'm going to tell you how to make something on a griddle today that most people don't think they can make on a griddle with that recipe. And I'll tell you that almost anything you can cook, you can do it with a flat top griddle. And a lot of stuff I'm going to give you today will apply to cooking on your stove, cooking on your grill, etc. Just there's things we can do with a griddle that are really, really cool. Then we'll talk about some techniques, hacks, and concepts for better overall results. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And again, if you found this and you were looking for like me standing out on my outdoor kitchen cooking, there'll be more content like that coming. There's some on the side already, but today we're going to just talk about this. So we also have to take care of our podcast sponsors. Sponsor today, number one today, is Above Phone, where you can replace big tech with your own private ecosystem. If you are using an Apple phone on AT&T or a Google Play phone on T-Mobile or whatever, this is what I know is happening to you. One, your provider is spying on you. Two, all the people that make the apps are spying on you, and the device manufacturer is spying on you. They don't call it spying. They call it data collection services. And there's really only one way out of it, and that is to run your own operating system and to run your own phone. And you can do that and still have AT&T as your cellular provider or what have you. But what you want to do is get over to Above Phone and check out all the options they have where you can take back your tech from big tech and have your own private ecosystem, run your own apps out of your own private app store. But what if you need to run an app? Like you just, there isn't something that will do what you need to do with this app that you have on your phone right now. So it's holding you back. Get rid of your phone. If it's on Google Play, you can install it. You can use all the conventional apps too. And you can put them on their own little jail cell. And they only do the things that you don't want them to do when you let them do it. Otherwise, they sit there inert. And that way, at least they're only running that type of service of collection of data, et cetera, when you willingly say, okay, I want to use this so much, I'll turn it on. And you, again, you wall it off. But what if I can't use a phone like that, Jack? Above Phone gives you an hour of consulting when you get an Above Phone. And if you're a member in my members program, $75 off any phone that they sell on their site. Check them out today at abovephone.com. Hey, we talked about taking our tech back. What about taking just your overall freedom back? How about the exit and build strategy made well known by John Bush at Live Free Academy? John is now running the 4th exit and build land summit where you can learn to build bountiful homesteads, create or join self-sufficient communities, and live radically free in a country surrounded by your people versus their people, and escape the tyranny of the modern-day cities and suburbs. You can learn all about that and more, including awesome homesteading skills, I'll be speaking there. Nicole Sauce will be speaking there. Molly Engelhart, just tons of great people, even Joel Salatin. So definitely consider you can come to the actual event in Bastrop. That's the best way to go. If you're going to do that, think about upgrading to the VIP tickets. Get to come to the special dinner and all of the other cool stuff that goes with the VIP tickets. Access to the green room where people like me hang out when we're not, you know, working, but we're there to be chatted to and stuff like that without a giant crowd. And it's just going to be awesome. And if you're like, I don't have the money, Jack, you can attend a lot of it virtually for free. And when you sign up for that, if you want additional access virtually, you can pay for the additional access. Did have a question recently about that, and I wanted to real quick cover that for you today. Somebody signed up for it and said, hey, what, I thought you said that there was like virtual access for free. I signed up and it immediately hit me up for like $160 or whatever. That's the upgrade. Once you sign up, you get access for free to the basic presentation. So if you've not signed up for Exit and Build because you didn't want to spend the money on it or didn't have the money to spend, know that you get a lot of virtual access. So online Zoom-like access at no cost. All right. With that, let's go ahead and dig on into it. Again, we're talking about flat top griddle cooking today. This is something I love to do. I've owned a Blackstone 36-inch four-burner griddle now for about 6 or 7 years. It is a godsend for cooking at my workshops. It's a godsend for large family gatherings. But I probably use it more than my Weber grill. I'm not going to say I use it more than my Salamander broiler, but it's pretty close in that. And in some ways, I would say I use it more because the Salamander broiler is a wonderful thing. If you've never experienced steaks cook under a super high temperature broiler, they're amazing. But I can make two steaks or two pork chops at a time and maybe a little bit of a side down in the bottom. If I'm cooking for 6-8 people because we're having people over on the weekend, I go straight to the griddle. And I'm going to talk about a lot of reasons why today. One of the reasons that we love cooking on griddles, and if you've never done it, once you start doing it, you will find this to be, you have amazing power, searing, and control when you're using a flat top griddle. This is why so many restaurants use griddles. In fact, there's more things cooked on griddles in restaurants that you order and eat than you know. Even a lot of things that might have spent some time over, let's say, open flame or something like that, like a steak, they'll often sear that on a griddle and then move it over to finish it. Or even sear it on a griddle and move it into a broiler to finish it. So they're really great, and they let you string out your food. And we'll talk more about that when we get into the techniques and hacks and things like that. But one of the things I love about when I have people over is serving food in courses, and you're not going to get, you know, the white, you know, tablecloth. I don't mean it that way. I just mean that, like, I like to sit down and eat with folks when they're over here visiting. I don't want to be working on stuff. So I'll get everything ready to go. And, like, we'll start with this thing and, like, an appetizer. And then we'll go to, like, a mid-meal and then, like, the main event. And then, like, maybe something to finish up with. And there might be 10, 20, 30 minutes in between those. So it's very social. It's a great way to do that. There's a lot to talk about with cleaning with griddles to maintain them right. But if you do what you should do, and we'll talk about that today as well, cleanup after cooking on a griddle is less, not more, work than cleaning up after, say, cooking on your stovetop. You have no pans. You have no pots. You have less utensils. Everything kind of is there. You know, all the grease goes in the trap, and all the junk off the griddle goes in the trap, and you dump it. So it's a real quick cleanup. And again, I'll talk a little bit about creating a regimen or a process so that you always do what you should do to keep it that way today, too. And you can make almost anything on a griddle. I have done baby back ribs on a griddle. Is it the best baby back ribs I've ever made? No. If I'm going to make baby back ribs, is it where I'm going to head to with it? No. Why did I do it? To prove that I could do it, to prove that it could be done. And they came out really, really good. You can bake on a griddle. Now, I wouldn't recommend like baking pies and cakes, but I mean, I'm talking like biscuits and stuff. It's a well-known hack. I'll tell you how to do that today. But you can make almost anything. And the reason that's cool is because griddles are portable. An electric griddle can go anywhere you have power, and a propane griddle can go anywhere that you take gas with you. And there's lots of like tabletop models in, let's say, the 14 to 22, 24 inch size range that you can take anywhere with you that, again, are gas powered. So they're good for camping and all. So if you go camping and you want to make breakfast for your family, a good flat top portable griddle is a great way to go. And you can even make biscuits to go with your breakfast. I'm not a big biscuit person, but I'm going to say this today as well. I actually love biscuits. I'm not big on eating them. I'm not big on eating bread. I stay very low on my carbs. I am going to pretend that's not true today in some of the things I'm going to talk about. I'm not going to constantly qualify it where you're a, Jack, you're supposed to be keto. Yeah, okay, fine. And what I'll tell you about that is when I do have a big gathering over here and I make something like I'm going to talk about like making bruschetta today, I eat bread. I don't do it often, but I do it. And then the other thing is not everybody does what I do. So if you want to make potatoes or bread or rice, you go ahead and you do that, and I'm not going to fault you for it. But the portable nature of it, along with the fact that you can make just about anything, gives you a lot of flexibility. And last is, again, cooking for a lot of people quickly. I don't know any way that I can personally make as much food for as many people and have it come out really great than a flat top griddle. More so even, I have a 6-burner Weber commercial gas grill. And I still can make a lot of food faster because the flat top is flat. Things don't fall through it. So I can make stir fry vegetables to go with an entree and things like that. It's just a fantastic way to cook. On gas versus electric, I don't want to say much, but I wanted to bring up a little bit today. Both have pros and cons. I think people, with good reason, when it comes to cooking, gravitate to gas. I have a gas range in my kitchen. When I moved into this house, we do not have gas service here, but we have a fairly large propane pig outside that we just actually got filled today. We get filled a couple times a year to make sure that it's never low. I so love gas for cooking. As someone who cooking is one of my passions, that if I had not had a propane pig here, I would have had one installed and switched the electric stove out for a gas stove. So I get all the advantages of gas. But there are trade-offs, especially when we get into griddles and portable griddles, or people that live places where they can't have gas service or don't have gas service. So the biggest advantage to gas for all these griddles is they will heat the cooking surface faster. You will get to a cooking temperature more quickly, unless you're talking about like some commercial 220-volt special electric griddle. Like gas was going to get you there faster. And then when it comes to portability, they're the ultimate in portability because if you can have gas at a place, you can have a gas griddle. So a lot of times when you go camping or something like that, you may not have power or you might not have sufficient power to run something like a griddle that's drawing 1,300 watts of power. Okay. The upside of electric, though, is you have a lot more precision in your control. Like gas is very precise, but you have to figure out the temperature yourself. You can't, I've never seen a gas griddle I can set to like 350 degrees or 390 degrees, where like my electric griddle I can set to a specific temperature. It'll take longer to get there, but if it's a good commercial quality with a thick base, it will tend to hold that temperature better and drop in temperature less. And those are great for people that have, you know, they live in an apartment. When I lived in an apartment, I've always loved to cook outside, loved to cook on the grill. I have a little cheap, you know, charcoal grills from Walmart for, you know, 30 bucks or whatever. And every time I fired it up, my landlord would inevitably end up yelling at me like I was going to burn the whole complex down. Even though it was no risk, it didn't matter. There were rules that I couldn't have it. Well, if I had been using a griddle, an electric griddle, there's no open flame. Piss off. So you can get that outdoor cooking experience and then all the good things that go with the griddle. And then if you have an electric, it's very easy if it's a portable size that you can bring it inside or outside. So that's some of the advantages there. And I wouldn't write either one off. I own both, specifically because of my relationship with Vavor. They sent me a 21-inch electric griddle I recently reviewed. I am blown away with how awesome those can be. Before I move on to accessories, I want to say that what we're talking about today are flat-top griddles, not just something called a griddle. So if you were to go to Amazon.com or Walmart.com or whatever and put in like kitchen griddle or cooking griddle or whatever, you'll find the Blackstones and the Camp Chefs and the commercial stuff I'm talking about. You'll also find a ton of shit that's basically like a pancake cake griddle or something like that. These are things that are 40, 50 bucks. They're electric with a single little element in them. They're usually nonstick coating bullshit. And they're fine for what they are. They are not what we're talking about today. They do not have the power or the heat retention to do some of the things that we're going to talk about doing today. And I will say this. There are some higher-end griddles that use non-stick coatings. I would stay the hell away from that. I don't want anything to do with something Teflon-like on a griddle. And it's not a health concern per se. I do think there's some risks with that, especially pushing higher temperatures. I am more looking at this like my Blackstone griddle like should last as long as I do. There is no reason for me to ever have to replace it if I maintain it. Anything with a coating is going to wear off. If your season coating on your good griddle wears off, you just season it again. You should be able to leave a good flat top to your kids, right? Like, even if the gas elements burn out, you can replace them. You can get parts for it. As long as it doesn't rust into the ground because you didn't take care of it, it should last forever. And I am not into spending lots of money on things that inevitably are going to fail when there's an alternative. Right. So I would stay away from artificial coatings altogether. I am going to be doing a combination now going forward where I'm going to, for those that are on audio only, you won't get the visual aids today. Some things I'll be bringing up on screen, and I have like a whole show and tell going on back here as well. So let's get on starting with some accessories. And these are all things either I think you absolutely need, you really should consider, or they're at least very nice to have. You can spend more money on shit to go with your griddle than your griddle. And I'm not here to be an infomercial today. But there are some things I think if you want to get the – and you guys, when I say need, I mean eventually. Like, you can just get a couple spatulas and start cooking on your griddle, okay? But these things, if you want to do some of the stuff we're going to talk about today and get to where you're cooking restaurant-quality food at home, which is the goal I have when I do shows like this, is to allow you to eat at, you know, a quality of like a super high-end restaurant for the same cost you're already spending on your food. Just by changing the technique and the cooking method, you can end up eating for the same price you already are, but elevating your eating. And if you really want to do that eventually, right, you want to get to that point, then the things I'm about to show you and talk to you about will enable that or make life just easier for you along that journey. So the first thing I will tell you is I just talked about longevity with a griddle, and they should last a very long time. And even if you screw up and it gets rust on it or whatever and you have to scrub it down and reseason it, that won't change. But every time you do that, you've lost something in your griddle, honestly. And it's just a lot of work to fix a griddle once it's jacked up than to just keep it from getting jacked up. And so I don't care, like my outdoor kitchen is completely undercover, but sometimes when it rains, rain comes in from the side. And no matter how good of a job you've done with your griddle, if water pools on top of your griddle surface in between cooking and it sits there long enough, it's going to start eating away that seasoning and rust. And what ends up happening is people buy a soft cover because they're cheap and they work. There's nothing wrong with them. But, okay, now I'm done cooking. Griddle's still fucking hot. If I put this vinyl thing on it, it's going to melt it. So I'm going to wait. And then everybody sits down and has a cocktail. And then I'll do it tomorrow. And then it rains overnight. And then you have to take the kids to Little League or some shit. And by the time you realize what you've done, you have rust all over your grill. And hopefully it's not so bad you have to fully reseason. Get a hard cover for your griddle unless it always is stored inside, closed in, not just over cover. The one that I have for mine is like an aftermarket product. Probably some guy is building them in his little metal shop at home or something, but it's made out of the diamond plate steel like they make toolboxes for trucks out of, and it's fantastic. Blackstone makes a lot of them, and you don't have to buy a brand match. Like, I have a Blackstone griddle, but a 36-inch griddle is a 36-inch griddle, and a piece of steel that goes over the top of it is good enough. But I really, and I mean really recommend that you get a hard cover for your griddle. Now, I've never used one of these, so I don't have one to recommend, but recently they have started to make, basically it's like a silicone mat, like a silicone cooking mat that fits, it goes straight onto the surface, and then you would still put your hard cover over it. I think it's overkill, but if you live in a really humid climate year-round, like Florida or Alabama, like Southern Alabama or something, you may really want to consider that additional protection. And since it's silicone and you're going to lay that down on the griddle surface, you know, as long as you're not putting it on there exactly when you're finished cooking, it's cooled at all, I'm guessing that it would be okay. You're not going to melt it because we have the same type of silicone we use in like baking trays and stuff like that. So I just think it's important to make sure that you can cover that surface while it's still at least warm, if not all the way hot, so that you will. Because every time you don't do it, bad shit happens sooner or later. I'll also tell you another thing you might want to consider doing. You might want to get a bungee strap or something like that and put it over that griddle cover. Why? Because last fall we had, as we typically do, some really strong storms from time to time. We had what we think was like a low end, like EF0 tornado that went like right through my neighbor's backyard. We had some serious crosswinds. And my griddle cover literally leapt up off my griddle and flew straight at my back door, which is a giant pane of glass. Fortunately, there is a post that holds the over it, like a support post, and it hit that, and it bent almost like a horseshoe around the thing and then hit the ground. I was standing there when it happened. I was like, holy shit! And it was like a 3D movie where you jerk back, but nothing happens. And, you know, to testify to how well made that thing is, I just took the post and used it to unbend it, fix the edges with some vice grips, and threw it back on, and it's fine. But I now strap it down because a piece of metal that's long like that can act like an airplane wing, which is exactly what happened. So that's a side note. Next up, I really recommend that you get a good griddle scraper, a cleaning scraper, because when you're cleaning that griddle, you want to scrape all that crud off of it. I've seen people do it with dough scrapers. I've seen them do it with things that look like a putty knife. I've seen people do it with spatulas, all different types of things that I've seen people use. Many, many years ago, before I even owned a flat top griddle, though, I was at a place called Tons Mongolian Barbecue, and they cook in like, it's a giant round griddle. There's like six dudes cooking at the same time. It's kind of like a Genghis grill, but it's better. More food, all you can eat, bigger griddle, just was an awesome place. There's only like a couple, three of them. It's like a small franchise here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I was watching these guys cook, and I saw them use this scraper, and it just did a fantastic job. And I'm like, whenever I get one of those, I'm getting one of those to go with it. This is what it looks like. It is made by Cuisinart, but plenty of people make very similar ones. And I have links to all these accessories in the audio notes for today's podcast. Just look up episode 3492 at thesurvivalpodcast.com. And you can find links to all this stuff. I've actually seen some of these that are made with all stainless steel, and they look really good, but I don't know that you need one. I don't know how much power you really need in a scraper. But a lot of people look at these, and for those, I'll try to explain what I'm talking about to those on the audio only. They have a lower piece with a beveled blade, and they have an upper piece here that's kind of shaped like a bulldozer, is kind of like a duckbill bulldozer upside down or something. And what the top, people think this blade is for scraping the top blade. It's not. It's a splash shield. It's a splatter shield. So it has two handles. So it's a two-handed tool. And when you're pushing it across your griddle, the crap that would fly up and hit you in the face, it hits this blade and doesn't hit you in the face. So this is not a scraping blade, but it's a flat, smooth, round edged blade, and what it's really good for is when you've knocked all the crap loose off the griddle and you're pushing it into your grease trap and you turn it over, it does a much better job of like shepherding it into the hole. The other thing I like about these is not only general design, but they have two wing nuts, and both of those blades come off the handle. And that means you can actually clean it, because everything that you touch with a griddle will end up with nasty, gross grease on it. So the beauty of this is that you can take this apart, throw these blades in the dishwasher, and just rinse off the handle. And I probably do that every couple, 3 weeks, because it gets nasty enough that I feel like it needs to be done. So I definitely recommend one of these. These are about $20. They are really, really worth it. And the first time you, if you own a griddle already and you've always cleaned it with like some other type of scraping tool or something, the first time you use this, you'll be like, why didn't I get one of these a long time ago? So I really recommend that. Next up is good, robust spatulas. Blackstone sells a ton of accessories. Some of it's very good. If you need a griddle cover, a metal griddle cover, the ones that Blackstone makes, even if you don't own a Blackstone griddle, they're fantastic. Blackstone spatulas suck. Most, if you go into like Amazon.com and you type griddle spatula, most of them suck. And the reason they suck is if I have a spatula and I like push down on a burger with it and it bends, it sucks. I'm looking for some reasonably heavy steel. I also want my steel for a griddle beveled like a blade edge, but I do not want the corners of the spatula pointed sharp square. I want the corners rounded, and I want the edge beveled. That will be a best all around. I didn't bring one for show and tell for you because my spatulas are actually really old, and you can't get them. I get a lot of stuff from like antique shops and stuff like that. These are the best ones. A set of three is only $24. They don't even really cost much more, but they're exactly what I said. They're heavy duty. They're full tang. They're wooden handled. They've got the bevel and they've got the rounded corners. And they have a long one, kind of a smaller, normal pan size one, and like a big wide shovel one. And I really recommend that. You may also want to consider getting a spatula that has some holes or slots or something in it for draining stuff, because since you're on a griddle, you can't use something like a slotted spoon for that. So that's a good idea too, though. I don't really do that. And when I give you one of my other accessories in a bit, you'll see why it's just mostly unnecessary for what I'm doing. But I definitely recommend get good, high quality spatulas. If that means going to a department store or something where you can put your hands on them and feel that they're just not made like crap, then I would take that extra step. And I'm telling you right now, the ones that come with your Blackstone griddle, the ones you buy with the Blackstone label on it, you would think Blackstone being one of the best brands out there in the griddle space, that they would really care about the quality of their accessories. In general, my experience is they don't. They make great griddles and they slap their name on other shit and get freaking decent quality, please. Thank you. For your own good, right? Next up, I really think that almost every new cook, indoors, outdoors, grill, I don't care, should have an instant read thermometer. I want to tell you right now, I don't use a thermometer very much with, you know, day-to-day cooking. I've gotten to where I can look at a steak. If I'm not sure, you can do the whole thing with, you know, which fingers do you touch and feeling your palm or your hand. I can be like, that steak's really rare. It needs to come up a little bit more, what have you. If I have really picky eaters and I'm making steaks for like 8 people, I'll use an instant read thermometer. If it's like a whole bird being roast and I haven't put, usually I use a meter thermometer for that just stays in there. But if it's something I'm not sure about, I'll check with it. But new cooks, you're going to be much better off with an instant read thermometer than without. And the reason is exactly not what you think. Everybody thinks that for your safety. Well, that's for your safety. If you undercook the food, you're going to die. You're probably not. I mean, about the only food that I would really, really, really worry about being undercooked in commonly eaten things today is going to be chicken. I'm not even worried about it that much with pork anymore. The odds of you getting trichinosis from pork are exceedingly low in modern times. I would still don't tempt that. The real problem when people do not have an instant read thermometer is because they're so obsessed and concerned with food safety and being undercooked. There it is. Jesse's got it. They overcook. So they're like, I'm not sure. So they keep going. and they end up overcooking, especially on when you're using a griddle to cook meat, which is about the only thing you're going to use this on. I guess you could use it in a baked good or something. I've never used an instant read thermometer for anything but meat. So let's say you're trying to hit, you're not even me. You're not going to eat that steak at the, you know, like really, really red, but you want that nice pink, cool center. You want to hit 140 at finish. And they're trying to hit that. And any piece of meat, and the thicker, the more this is true, is going to have what's called carryover. So I pull it at 135, it's going to climb at least to 140. So if I think I'm where I want to be, and that's 140, and I pull it at 140, it's going to climb 145, 146, 147. And this is going to be more true with a flat top griddle cooked piece of meat than some other, because there's so much power, it's so much radiant heat going into that pork chop or that steak. So by having the instant read and understanding carryover, you can pull at the temperature you need to pull at until you develop more experience, and you can do this on your own. And then in certain things, you really don't want to overcook it. So if you're cooking chicken thighs, and I'll talk about that a bit today in the next segment, you can overcook chicken thighs. I've heard people say you can overcook anything. Yesterday, I overcooked 2 pieces of andouille sausage. Usually you don't overcook sausage. I put it on the grill after I was done with the show and went into editing and forgot about it for an hour, and I made 2 chew sticks for Charlie out of them. They were indirect heat, but it was still just – it was massacred, right? When you're cooking chicken breast, though, the difference between perfectly cooked and overcooked is a few degrees. And people really freak out about chicken with good reason. Like, it is the thing that would carry the most potential potential pathogens with an undercook of just about anything we eat in America today. So they take this big giant chicken breast, first mistake, butterfly the damn thing and get it into a uniform thickness. Okay. They take this big chicken breast, they throw it on the griddle with some kind of marinade or something. They can't get any color on it. Why? Why can't they get any color on it? Because they didn't get it dry and they're boiling the damn thing, even though it's on a super hot flat top. They finally boil off the stove, they make a sticky mess out of it, they start to cook it, it starts to burn, and then they feel it, and they know it's not done, and they keep going, and the next thing you know, it goes from being undercooked chicken, which tastes gross, and you shouldn't know that because you shouldn't eat undercooked chicken, to being overcooked chicken, which tastes like ass, right? It's just overcooked white meat chicken is dry crap, and so you really want to dial in that temperature management with all things, but really, really, really with any white meat of poultry. And chicken would be the number one in America today. Next, I think that it's really a great idea to have some sort of a basting dome. And this is something I got sold on long term, or it took longer for me to get sold on it than other things. Because I'm a big improviser. I don't want to buy a thing that I don't need. So I have tons of little throwaway aluminum pans, and we're going to talk about using those. Just throw that upside down on top of it. And then when you got to take it off, you're jacking around with a pair of tongs, trying not to burn yourself. And because it's so thin, it's really good at letting heat come through it, but it's not really good at keeping heat in. So it's not the best lid. So I've used pot lids, I've used cake pans, etc. And I thought one day, Jack, this is stupid. You're not a cheap person. You're a frugal person. Why don't you look and see what the best basting dome, warming dome is that you can find and see how much it costs. And I've never been a fan of little round ones because they don't cover but one thing at a time. And if I'm on my griddle, I'm usually cooking for more than a couple people. And if that's the case, then I want to be able to cover a couple things with them. And I found these. And I do, again, I have a link to all of these in the show notes today. And what I had actually thought about doing was just getting some cheap cake pans, because that's kind of what these are, drill a hole in it and get a pull for like a cabinet pull, and just stick one of those on there for a handle so you don't burn yourself. And there you go. Turns out these cost less than even decent cheap cake pans. And they're about the size of a cake pan. In fact, that may be what they actually are, and then they were repurposed. I don't know. They have a nice little handle, and they have a vent, right? They have a vent, right, that you can open up so they can either allow some heat to vent or they can completely lock it in. The company that makes these makes them with a vent and without a vent. They cost the same price. And I think a set of two of them is like $21, so they're about $10 a piece. So you can buy one if you want to. I say go ahead and get two. If you are, you know, especially if you have a larger griddle and you cook a lot of food at one time, because it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. And these do so much for you. The number one thing they do, of course, is to melt cheese on those burgers. And doing that is actually really easy with a little hack. And that is, when I go to put this down over a burger with cheese on it, I take a squeeze bottle or a glass of water or whatever, and I put a little bit of water around the food, and I put this over it. And the steam then will melt that cheese very, very quickly. Now, that's just not all we can do with that little hack, though. When you are doing eggs, and you want to do like sunny side up eggs, or you want to go a little further till they look like they're over easy, but you don't want to break the yolks and you don't want to flip them, same thing. Put that over your eggs, a little bit of water. What's happening is the steam is 212 degrees. It takes a long time for air to heat up. So when you have that egg sitting on that griddle, if you put your hand right above that egg, right where that yolk is, it's not that hot. All the heat is coming from the bottom and going into the egg and dispersing through it. When you put that dome on it, the temperature does begin to come up. But when you throw that water down, that steam fills that. It's instantly over 200 degrees surrounding that egg, and that will get you that partially cooked yolk. My big thing with this is I love a runny yolk. I love it on a burger, on a plate with bacon for breakfast. I'll put runny yolk on just about any food that humans consume. It's the old, especially from a duck. A duck runny yolk is like, even when it's very barely cooked, it's already thick. It's almost like butter. It's just a gorgeous sauce for all foods. I do not like runny white. Runny white is nasty. And what ends up inevitably happening if I try to make an egg without flipping it is either I cook it more than I want to, or that yolk, the white part around the yolk ends up gooey, nasty, not fully cooked, not bueno. And with that hack, it always gets done perfectly. And I don't just do that on griddles. Like I said, a lot of this stuff is translatable. If I'm cooking eggs on my stovetop and I've got my Lodge 12-inch, carbon steel skillet, and I'm cooking eggs in it, and I'm doing the same thing, a little bit of water, throw any standard size lid on there and do the same thing. It's a fantastic way to kind of use steam basting to finish off eggs. And there's a lot of other things that we can do that with, including if you have a good sear on, don't do this until you got a good sear, but if you have a good sear on a steak and you have like four normal people and one weirdo who wants their steak really cooked more than it should be and you want everybody's together and you tried to make theirs come ahead and it just didn't, throw the thing over it to finish the steak, sure. But the water in that will help too. And will also help to get them their ruined steak not quite as ruined. Because I've actually gotten pretty good at cooking almost well done and not drying out a steak. It's taken years of practice to do, though. But that's one of many hacks I've used for that. Next is presses. And everybody thinks of Smashburgers, and I will do an homage to the spatula or the Smashburger today. But that's not really where I'm going with this. So I am a frequenter of like antique malls and stuff like that. It's not something like every weekend I'm out antiquing or anything like that. But if I'm somewhere that I've never been before and I look and they have like an antique mall or something, I want to go there. I'm not looking for fine crafted oak furniture. I'm looking for cool shit that you can't get anymore. And many years ago, there's a little antique mall just up the road from me. I've only ever found one of these. But I have found a modern version thereof, and this is the modern version. It's an aluminum burger press. Why aluminum? Because it's lightweight. So whenever I post pictures of me cooking and I'm using the one that I have from the antique mall, it's got this dark gray patina on it, so I'm not sure people know it's aluminum. And if I have it like sitting on top of a chop or a steak, why are you pressing a steak? I am making sure that it doesn't curl, and I'm making sure it has full contact with the cooking surface, and I'm speeding up the cooking. And I'm not pressing it because there's not enough weight there to press it. It's very, aluminum is very, very light. It's not cast iron. That's why I prefer aluminum presses. If you don't and you want to use cast iron or something, like, go ahead. I'm not anti-cast iron. I'm just pro-aluminum. I've had people say, it's aluminum, you're going to die. And then they go and cook their potatoes in aluminum foil, and I just don't bother. As far as aluminum being a health risk with cooking, unless you're like using an aluminum pot to cook tomato sauce in every day, stop worrying about it. Just don't worry about it. This is sitting on top of your food. Number one use that I use these for, though, is bacon. And I don't think, unless you're trying to speed the cooking up because you have like a piece of bacon that's being stubborn, you really need to go vertical with them. So these are, I don't know, they're about 8 inches by 4 inches wide. I have two, and I set them on the ends of the bacon, and I keep moving them down the line of bacon just so that it doesn't curl up, so the bacon will cook fully for me. That's the number one thing. They're fine for pressing burgers. Everybody wants a round press to do a smash burger. The burger doesn't know what shapes over top of it, and you are a human. You have dexterity. You can go press, turn 90 degrees, and finish pressing. If you want a round one, get one. I have a link to these in the Amazon notes because this is the only company I have found that makes these aluminum versions of these presses in the modern day. The one that I found in the antique mall, and I'm always looking for more of these, that company has been out of business for 111 years. And Oki Storm Chaser says use a brick wrap and a couple layers of foil. And I would add to that, you might want to look and see if you can find like the half bricks, like the facing bricks, because you don't really need a lot of weight. But brick chicken's pretty good shit too. So that's another thing. But definitely consider getting some presses because I think you'll just be you'll get more out of things if you do that. Next up, people are big on dough scrapers as griddle scrapers and for cleanup and everything and for scraping burgers like a smash burger and getting it off the grill and stuff. I don't really get why people want to use dough scrapers. Dough scraper, and I'll put it up on the screen, the one I would recommend if you insist on getting one. This is the best one I found because it has beveled edges and it's very heavy duty. And they're like $10. But dough scrapers are for scraping dough off a board. That's what they're for. And when you're scraping dough off of a wooden cutting board, are you worried about burning your knuckles? I hope not. So to me, why you would want to put your hand that close to the searing surface of a griddle to use a dough scraper, I don't really get. There is nothing that you can do with a dough scraper that I can't do with a good spatula. And I use the other tool that I showed you for cleaning the griddle. So I don't use one. But if you want one, I have a link to the one that I would say if you're going to get one, get this. It's a pretty damn good tool for what it is. Again, I just don't see a real need for it, in my opinion. Some of you will disagree. Another thing that I do recommend, though, especially if you have one of the newer Blackstones, where the grease trap is in the back, and the grease trap's actually a pretty big hole. It's something called a griddle goalie. And it's way over here. So this is a cool little tool. And all this thing is a piece of stainless steel, and right where your grease trap is, it slides over the grease trap, and it lets the grease pass through, and it doesn't let food fall into the grease trap. Now, I don't generally have a problem with, like, when I'm cooking, like, a shrimp rolling to the back. What ends up happening is when your griddle's full and you're cooking for a lot of people and you're moving your stuff around with your spatulas, inevitably some piece of food wants to plunge into the nasty grease trap. And then you're trying to get tongs and pull it out and you try to poke from the other side and you burn yourself. Like, not good. Not fun. Not what I'm looking for. That little thing, they're like $8, $9, $10, depending on which brand you buy. I don't even care what you buy. I have a link to that. Well, I think I have a link to like a lookup on Amazon for you where you see all the different options. Because what you want to do is make sure you buy one that will work for your grease trap. Some griddles, you wouldn't need one. The Vivor electric one I have has the grease trap in the front. There's like a long trough. You pull the nastiness forward and then you push it into that hole. I can't see with the way you work a griddle from the front knocking food out to the front. You always push it to the back to the gates. So I've had people say to me in some of my videos recently that like all the commercial griddles that they've ever seen in a restaurant have the grease trap in the front, so that must be better. I don't think it's better. I think it's a preference and it's situational. if you go into a restaurant and a kitchen, you go to a huge, beautiful restaurant, kitchen is cramped. Like, cooks in restaurants have, like, their own language, like moving behind you, and you'll actually touch the person on the back because it's such tight quarters. And so you usually can't easily get to the back of a thing. So by putting their grease traps in the front, they're able to clean everything from the front and service everything from the front. So I think it's really more of that. But what I can say for the front model is, again, you're not knocking shit to the front. You're always knocking shit to the back. But $9 and you never have to lose a shrimp into the grease trap again, you know, I know you want to feed it to the dog after that because he's going to go, you know, postal diarrhea for eating that much grease. So you've lost a shrimp, you've lost a piece of scallop, you know, whatever. A couple of those times and the damn thing paid for itself, let alone the frustration that it saves. And then the next thing is a cooling rack. And I do have one of those as well, a cooling rack. And this is a standard sheet pan cooling rack that I'm holding for those that can't see it. And it's just basically a grid pattern rack with a little bit of lift. And what these are really for is you bring a piece of bread, a freestanding bread loaf out of the oven. Cookies, you take them off the sheet. You set them on here so you get airflow and they cool. So that's why they call them a cooling rack. These are the thing that so many griddle owners don't know they need in their life. So you're making a bunch of bacon and eggs. The bacon is getting finished in batches. You don't want the bacon to get cold, and you don't want the bacon to overcook. You set this on the warm, so you take your griddle, you create heat zones, hot, medium, warm. You put this over the warm side of your griddle. You take the bacon, you put it on here, it stays warm, it stops cooking. That alone is awesome. Plus, it then drains all the excess grease onto the griddle, and it goes up in the grease trap. If you have a big griddle, I think these are a perfect size. These are a standard sheet pan size. And I love to use multitaskers. I don't like unitaskers. So these, again, fit right in a standard baking sheet pan, a shallow baking pan. So I could bake it in my oven with this. I take the sheet pan, I coat it with foil so there's no cleanup. I set this in it. I put the bacon on here. The bacon bakes. The grease drips down into the pan. Take the bacon grease, put it into a ball jar. Now I have bacon grease for cooking. Perfectly clean, unlike when you fry it in a pan. And you throw the foil away. Or make more bacon and keep using it until it's time to throw it away. But then I can take this out, put it on my griddle, use it as a hold warm space. I'll also talk later about how we can take this and we can use this to do something like bake biscuits. So there's a lot that we can do with that. And I feel like I missed something. I did. I don't see it in my notes. I may have lost it out of my notes, but I will make sure that I add it to the notes for you. But my item of the day from yesterday, the E-Tech City laser thermometer. These, you just point, push a button, and let's see, can I? that you have to come look up this point in the video at 47 minutes and some seconds on in to see what I did there if you are listening to the audio and you want to see it. But what you do, you point this, pull the trigger, look at it, and it tells you what the temperature is. So the surface of my desk is 82 degrees right now. That's probably actually, let's see, 84. Wow, these little Mac, thin MacBooks, man, they run cool. Okay, so that's good. So 90 degrees. What this lets you do is understand the temperature of your griddle surface. And as you work over time to improve your skills, you'll start to see recipes that say, you know, pancakes about 350 degrees. Pancakes are beautiful at 350 degrees. You pour pancake batter on a griddle at 350, it immediately starts to firm up. The edges start to dry. Then you wait. You see little holes in the batter. When the little holes form in the batter, you flip the pancake, perfectly brown. 320 degrees, that pancake cooks like dog crap. And there's a lot of things like that. Is this an essential? No, but they're $18. They do about 1,000 things other than help you with your cooking. And so I really recommend that you get one. I have like 3 or 4 of these because I lose shit all the time. And by having multiples, when I lose one, I find the other. One of the things I really like that E-Tech City did with the latest version they have of this gun is it now uses AA batteries instead of a stupid 9-volt. Or AAA batteries instead of a stupid 9-volt. So I have rechargeable AAAs and AAs all over the place. I always have batteries for it. So I definitely recommend that. Oh, that instant read thermometer. The new instant read thermometer I'm recommending as well also uses, it's either AA's or AAA's. I don't remember. I think it's AAA. I really recommend if you're going to, I don't care what instant read you buy, as long as it's not crap, as long as it works good, because there are some junk ones. I really recommend getting one that uses a standard battery instead of the watch battery type or hearing aid battery type. And the reason is everyone I've ever owned that uses that kind of battery, when you change that battery, they're such a bitch, or something about the way they manufacture the screw cap and the handle, they're very difficult to get back together. And I had one that, like, after like six times of screwing with it, I threw it away and bought one with a standard battery. It just wasn't worth it to me anymore. So I really recommend adding that. Otherwise, I think I covered everything with accessories. Now let's talk about some recipes. That's why you're here, right? What can I cook, Jack? And I'm about to give you something. And understand that most of the time when I give you a recipe, I'm not going to be like 2 tablespoons of this, a dash of that, a pinch of this. And like, I give you generalities because that's how I cook. There's very few things that I have dialed down to, like, where I have a recipe on a piece of paper or in notes. Sausage, I do that with because I want repeatable results, et cetera. But most of my cooking, including what I'm about to give you here, is very flexible, and you do it by eye. And so what I want to start out with is, when we think cooking on a griddle, we always think about frying, searing, cooking. We don't think about things, and this is not one that we're going to do with this recipe, we don't think about things like deep frying, though. Do you know you can deep fry on a griddle? Do you know what you need? Those throwaway aluminum pans. You set that on your griddle. You fill it with oil, maybe halfway. You don't want to fill it too much. Right? You don't want overflowing oil when you fry on a griddle with open flame under it. Bad news. Ask an ER doctor what happens on Thanksgiving with turkeys and deep fryers. So you add that, you bring your temperature up, and you get your oil to the temperature you're looking to fry at, which means you'll have to bring the griddle surface above that temperature, by the way. And then you can do things like, if you were making some sort of Mexican food, you wanted fresh fried tortilla chips, take some corn tortillas, cut them in fourths, and you get your triangular chips, and you can fry them, and then you can take them out of that deep fryer, and you can put them on a cooling rack over the heat to keep them nice and warm. And while they're still nice and warm and oily, you hit them with salt, and then you take them into your guests, and they'll have better tortilla chips than they probably ever had in their life that way. So that's how these things go. Now we're going to use that concept that I can cook in a foil disposable pan, and we're going to change it. And I'm about to tell you how to make something right now. If you ever have, like, guests, like, I'm talking like 4 to 6 people is where this is an ideal meal, maybe up to 8 to make. And you want to blow them away. And you want them to leave and feel like they went to a very expensive restaurant, but you don't want to really spend a ton of money. Then this is for you. And I've done this with a bunch of things, but I'm going to talk about doing it with clams and mussels right now, because you can get mussels really cheap, and you can get a few clams to go with it, and it'll be fantastic. I'm also going to serve bread with this. Keto be damned, Kenberry be damned, I'm going to put bread with this, and when you hear what you do, I'll explain why. So the recipe I'm going to give you, but I'm going to give you some mods to it: clams, mussels, and sausage with wine, butter, and cream. Intrigued? Okay, check this shit out. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to take that aluminum pan. We're going to go over like a medium low to medium heat, kind of in that range. We're going to throw a cup of wine, usually 2 cups of wine. You know the little Bota boxes they sell of wine? It's like 3 glasses. One of those is what I usually, just a Chardonnay, dump the whole thing in there. A stick of butter. And then whatever herbs you want. I like to go kind of toward the Italian side with this. Fennel seed. Maybe some fennel fronds if I have fresh fennel in the garden, which I always do. Basil, oregano, thyme, rosemary. And if you have fresh sprig rosemary, sprig thyme, just throw the whole thing in there. Take a whole head of garlic. Take a knife and cut it in half across the cloves so it's exposed. Paper and all, throw it in there. It's fine. It's going to be fine. You don't have to worry about it. Okay? Let it begin to simmer. And once it starts simmering for a little while, turn it way down so it's a bare simmer. You want to cook the alcohol off the wine. You're going to be doing other things while this is going on. By the time that happens, though, the garlic's probably softened. Take tongs, pull the garlic out, set it on your cooling rack, but over a board, not over the griddle. Let it cool enough so it doesn't burn your hands. Once it cools down, pick it up and squeeze it. And instead of sitting there picking all those clothes out, they will confit in the oil or the butter and the wine, okay? And they will squeeze right out for you, yeah? While all this is going on, take a good, flavorful, spicy sausage, a chorizo, whether it's a Mexican or a Spanish chorizo, either one, an andouille, anything like that. Chop it up fine. If it's raw in a case, just decase it and cook it on your flat top. About a half a pound. Once it's browned, throw it in the pan. Throw it in the pan. Yeah? Okay. Now, take your clams and your mussels. Put them in the pan. Turn up the heat. Put another pan on top of it. By the way, these little domes that I recommend, they fit perfectly over the smaller size aluminum throwaway pan. So you can use another pan or you can use one of these. And with these, they have a little vent. You can even vent them a little bit if you want to. And steam them until the mussels open. Okay? That's it. When they're open, they're done. Pour some cream in. How much? As much as you want. And mix it up. Take that, put it on a board, take some bread, good like sourdough or something, cut it in pieces, hit it with some olive oil or some butter, toast one side with a fat so that it's nice and brown. Once that side's got some color on it, flip it over and just warm the other side, but leave it a little bit soft so it's not fully toasted on the second side and it's a dry toast. Set that on a board with that thing and just tear ass into that. If you want to really push it over, chives or green onions right at the end and some fresh basil, fine sliced over the top of it, and it'll look beautiful. You serve that to somebody, and they will swear to God that they're sitting at a restaurant, and that is a $40 table appetizer. You can make it for about $10. Because you don't need, you know, if you won't drink wine, don't cook with it. You don't know what I'll drink then. I'll go some pretty, I won't go to MD 2020, but I'll go pretty low on my wine. A little box of wine, a little juice box of wine that sells for $4 or $5. I would totally drink that if I was going to drink wine. I also left out squeeze bottles. Damn it. Definitely get yourself some squeeze bottles. I have a link. This is another thing. Don't buy from Blackstone. They'll send you a couple squeeze bottles with your Blackstone griddle if you buy from them. And, they will crack and break and turn to shit, and they will leak. And if you buy another one, they'll do the same thing. That's my experience, and everybody I've ever watched that makes content based on griddle cooking, this is the same thing. These things, I think these are like the big ones, and I think for a six-pack, they're like $20. So they're $3 a piece or something like that. So they cost less. They don't have anybody's logo on them. And by the way, these do so many things for you. So sauces, oil, water for control on your griddle, water for – I use – this one is actually here because I had started plants in my office this year, and I use it for watering seedlings because it's a precision applicator. So a little bonus content for you there. Next up, Szechuan pepper beef kebabs. I'm not going to get into the recipe. In the audio notes for this episode, there's a link to where you can get the peppercorns, and it's got the recipe – and this one is a recipe because I scaled it to feed 80 people this. Several people have been to workshops here where I've done these, and it usually results in a hover while I'm on the flat top making them and people waiting for the next batch to come off. But it uses sake. It uses a little bit of sugar. It uses a lot of Szechuan peppercorns. Szechuan peppercorns are actually not from the pepper family. They're a berry from a tree. And they have a heat that's not really that intense, and they have a numbing-like sensation they create in your tongue, and it's a really cool thing. But you can do what I'm about to say with a bunch of different types of kebabs. And so you marinate them in this thing, and then there's a dry rub that you make, and then that goes on before you cook them, and it goes on after they're cooked as a little kicker, and it is just fantastic. But I put this in today so I could give you something that you really need to know. You really need to know. And Jesse, you're asking, what do I mean by spine sliced? I don't know what that means. So explain that, and I will answer that question for you later. But when you marinate a meat, it's been wet. Wet meat does not go on grills. Wet meat does not go in pans. Wet meat does not go on flat tops. Wet meat equals, when you know when you're driving and they teach you about hydroplaning and it's raining and you try to hit the brakes and your car slides and you actually have a surface tension and the tire's not actually touching the concrete anymore and you're riding on a thin surface of water. When you throw wet meat into a pan, onto a griddle, no matter how hot it is, what happens is that moisture starts to go to steam immediately and it sits almost like a hovercraft. And you end up with steam and wet between the meat and the griddle. That does not equal sear. So when you marinate something, it's very important to completely drain it and give it time to get sticky. A good marinade, if you give it some time to air dry after you've kind of dried it off, and patting it with a paper towel and all, not a bad idea either. Again, but what I'm back to is I will set marinated meats on cooling racks like this so that they can air dry and get tacky. When they get tacky, then they're going to sear beautifully, and they're going to cook much better. So these are delicious. There's some, like, Worcestershire sauce and some things in the recipe that really tenderize the meat. It's a 24-hour marinade. But I wanted to talk to you about, one, what I just did, which is how not to cook meat, which is wet on your griddle. Do not boil shit. I have actually had people, when I've had them cook for me in certain situations, and I've had a pre-marinated product in a vacuum seal bag, cut it open and dump it on the griddle. I'm like, oh, no, you're boiling it. That's not good. You want to make sure, again, that you give it time to dry off. The other thing is, what is the purpose of making kebabs on a griddle versus a conventional kebab? And you have to understand where kebabs came from to understand why it's not what you might normally think, which is because they're kebabs. So kebabs really came from, like, the Ottomans and the Turks and what have you. When they were on campaigns, military campaigns, and they were cooking meat, they would dig a long trench and they would fill the trench with coals. So it was hot. And then all the soldiers would cook their meat over that trench, and they would take, like, their short swords or their daggers, and they would put the meat on it. And then the trench would hold the meat over, or the edges of the trench would hold the meat over the coals. And so it was cooked with high heat and air, and it cooked really fast. And it tastes, anybody's ever done it, it tastes really good. So when you cook with kebabs, if you're trying to make a traditional kebab, you don't want the meat in contact with the grill surface or what have you. So this one is from a place called Cave Tools, and I'll explain what I like about it in just a second. But they actually make a little rack thing to hold it up off the grill so you can do that. And that would be your traditional kebabs. One of the things you can do if you have a grill that has multiple grill plates, you can just simply take the grill, like one of the plates out in the center, and then span this just like the Ottomans did over their little trench. On a griddle, we're doing this for a different reason. There will be no culinary difference between using this skewer and just throwing it on the griddle and cooking it. But what will happen is you'll have much easier time controlling it and turning it. So if I want both sides seared beautifully, I don't have to chase pieces around. I can take everything off the grill. So that is why we do this. I like doing it with shrimp. I like doing it with anything that's lots of small pieces rather than a couple big pieces of meat. What you want in a skewer is you want it flat. So it's really thin one way, and it's like a flat kind of blade the other way, so that when you turn something, it doesn't rotate on the skewer. I know that kebabs look cool when you do, like, a pepper, a mushroom, a piece of meat, a pepper, a mushroom, a piece of meat. I know it looks cool. Doesn't cook worth shit, especially when you're doing a surface contact cook. And they all cook at different speeds, right? So if you want to do skewers and you want to do vegetables and all, do a skewer of peppers. Do a skewer of mushrooms. Do a couple skewers of meat. Do them separately. That way you can pull them when they're actually done. You'll get better results. If you don't have these, then you're going to use bamboo skewers. And when I make these kebabs for, like, 80 of you people when you're here, I don't have 80 of these things, and I need to have them all ready to go when I start cooking, because I'm going to spend an hour cooking for you guys while you stand and stare at me and go, you got any more? You got any more? Hey, are we to the back of the line yet? No, Jake, get to the back of the line, asshole. You don't get seconds till everybody gets first, Jake. You guys know what I'm talking about that I've been here. And so I'll use bamboo, the little cheap brown bamboo ones. What you do then, each skewer is made with two. So you have your shrimp or whatever, and you have your skewer going through one and then the other, and that way when you turn them, you're turning two and they don't spin on you. Also, soak those in water, even if they're going to be on a flat top, not over open flame, because they will tend to ignite and catch on fire in high temperature. Best way to soak your bamboo skewers, okay? Get an old water bottle or something that's a long, tall water bottle. Put them in there, fill up with water, put the lid on. That way the whole skewer is underwater at the whole time. And you can soak about 30 or 40 in a standard long, tall water bottle, right? So that's just another little hack I'm giving you right there today. But there's your kebabs, and I definitely recommend if you're going to buy skewers, buy ones that are flat in one dimension so you don't have that rolling problem. Next, tomato and pepper bruschetta or bruschetta, because both pronounces are accurate. And Jesse's still not. Jesse's saying, and I usually save questions to the end, but I'm not going to remember this if I don't do it now. Spine slice was referring to the end of the first recipe, clams and mussels and sausage. Oh, I know. Okay. I said spiral sliced. I think I have that for you under hacks. So we'll get to that. Spiral sliced sausage. Really, really cool. Tomato and pepper bruschetta. I don't know when. I do know when. There was a place called Carini's. And the guy that ran it was named Joseph Garamia. Real Italian guy. Lived over the restaurant in Northampton, Pennsylvania. His mama lived over the restaurant. His mama, I say Italian, he was Sicilian. They get mad. Sicilians get mad when you call them Italians. I don't know, you know, it's a thing. And she didn't even speak English, right? That's how old country this guy was. And he had moved to small town Pennsylvania from Manhattan. He busted his chops in Manhattan becoming a chef, and he decided to kind of retire as a chef owner in this little hamlet. And the first time I ever had bruschetta, I was like, oh, my God, where's this been my whole life? And I said, how do you make this? He said, no, I cannot tell you. Well, it took me about 5 minutes to reverse engineer almost everything this guy did. And people that love bruschetta tell me that mine is the best they've ever had. I don't think they're blowing smoke up my ass because they're the kind of people that would tell you, you suck if you suck. And I don't really have a recipe for it. Again, I just have what I do and a technique behind it. And the bruschetta part has nothing to do with the flat top. The flat top's only the bread. But remember I said about having like multi-course meals? This is like the most incredible opener to something like that you could do for a group of people. All I do is I take tomatoes, and I've been a big fan of using Roma tomatoes for this, but there's a cherry tomato that's now available at a lot of markets. It's called something like Dark Knight or something like that. They're almost black, like a blue-black, and they come in a little container. They make the best bruschetta I've ever made, other than my fresh tomatoes when they're available for my garden. Okay, and I'll use about one container of those to two big bell peppers. And I like to use peppers that are like an orange and a yellow so there's more color contrast. And all you do is chop them up fine. The way I do that, I have a little mini food processor. I throw them in there. This is my secret, though. I'm giving you the secrets today. I take a colander. So the tomatoes are done. I dump them in the colander with a bowl under it because they're going to leak. I hit them with some salt. I mix it up, and I go sit it in the sink. And I let the salt extract the extra moisture from the tomatoes and let it drain down into the sink. While that's going on, I cut up my peppers. I put those in the mini food processor. I chop those up. I throw now the tomatoes into the final bowl that I'm going to serve it in. I put the peppers in the colander. I salt them, and I let those drain their excess moisture in the sink. Now I chop up about 4 or 5 cloves of garlic. They go in the mini food processor. Now the peppers go in the bowl. The garlic I don't drain. It doesn't need to be drained. You mix that up. Then I take a big handful of basil, stack the leaves together, roll them up like a cigarette, and give them a chiffonade. That's a fancy term for it's fine slices. It makes little threads. And if you don't know how to do a chiffonade, look it up. Plenty of videos to show you how to do it. Throw that in there. You mix that up. Couple tablespoons of good quality olive oil. Extra virgin is best, but it's not really that important. And then about 1 tablespoon of a good red balsamic vinegar. And then, and this I got from Mr. Garamia, who wouldn't tell me, but I kept going, I know there's something here. A little bit of fish sauce. If you don't have any fish sauce, you could use a little bit of Worcestershire. But there was always like this anchovy thing going on in his bruschetta. And when I tried using, like, actually like chopping up an anchovy, a canned anchovy, it was too much. It's just a, like a Red Boat number 40 fish sauce, works great for this. Like three or four dashes of that, like bitters in an old fashioned. Mix that up, put that in your refrigerator. Right when you go to serve it, get another good handful of basil, tear the leaves instead of and throw those on it, kind of leave them on the top. When you're ready to serve it, get like a baguette style, Italian style, sourdough, whatever, long thin piece of bread, cut it into sections about half an inch thick, brush one side with oil. You can rub it with garlic. You know, there's plenty of garlic in there. I just take garlic powder and sprinkle the top with garlic powder and then a pinch of salt. And then toast those, like I said, the other bread. Toast the one side till it's good and brown. Flip them and just kind of gently toast the other side so the bread's soft and crunchy, right? When you put them down on the board or the plate you're going to serve it with, get some rosemary and thyme. And rosemary's kind of big needles, so take a little mortar and pestle if you have it. Couple pinches of rosemary in there and kind of grind it up, and then throw like, you know, a couple pinches of thyme in there and mix it together and sprinkle the rosemary and thyme on top of the toasted bread. Serve that with on the side a little bowl full of fine shaved good Parmesan. People will blow their minds eating this. It is so simple and so fresh, and yes, it's got bread. The bruschetta itself can be used a myriad of ways. You can put it on salads. You can do all kinds on a steak. It's delicious on steak. But for that kind of like, you know, you're bringing friends in. You're taking several hours to enjoy food together. You open with that and a cocktail or a glass of wine. And, oh, my God, I have to stay away from it except for those occasions because I would be back to being 300-pound Jack because I could eat that every freaking day of my life. It is that good. And so do you need a flat top to do that? No, I've toasted the bread on the grill. I've toasted it in the oven. I've toasted it on the stove. But if I'm going to cook with the flat top for people, that's my go-to leadoff. And a lot of times I'll go from that to something intermediary, and then I'll go to something like those mussels. And, I didn't tell you what I did with that. Adapt these recipes. Adapt these techniques. This weekend, I wanted to make that. But my wife doesn't like mussels and clams. She's not a bivalve person at all. She loves lobster, okay with shrimp, on scallops. Had some scallops in the freezer, had some shrimp in the freezer, went to the grocery store, bought some lobster tails, the little ones, bought like four of them, cut them in half with a knife. I took the shrimp, the scallops, and the lobster tails. I hit them with Old Bay. I did everything I said with that recipe, except I took the lobster tails and put a meat side down on the griddle until I got color on the meat, threw them in the pan. The shrimp got a little color on both sides of the shrimp, but they weren't fully cooked. Threw them in the pan. Threw the scallops down last because they're quick to cook. Tossed them around with the spatula to get a little bit of color on them because they were the little bay ones. I couldn't really get a good sear on them. Threw those in the pan, steamed them, finished. And for sausage, didn't have chorizo. I used a couple pieces of andouille. Freaking amazing. I used some fresh sage, some fresh basil, and some fresh garlic chives and from the garden. That was one of the best things. That my wife, when she dipped a piece of bread into that, was like, oh, my God, you have to do this again. I'm like, we can't do this all the time because we're both going to blow back up from too many carbs. Moving on to the smash burger. I'm going to give you the real quick thing on a smash burger, what the trick to it is. You have to treat a smash burger like a pancake, right? You just can't really do it unless you understand that concept. So the way you do a smash burger, you're going to take about a big smash burger is going to be 4 ounces of ground beef, and it's going to look like a little meatball. Season it however you want if you need to. Really, salt and pepper is all you need with this. And what you want to do is you're going to take that little meatball and you're going to set it on your griddle. And then you need a piece of like parchment paper. And you're going to set that on top of it, and you take your press and you smash it down until it's really, really thin. And you get it nice and thin, and then you peel the paper off it. This is the important part. Leave it alone. You want that sear. You want it cooking in its own juice, and you don't want the grease and fat coming out of the burger to do this right. Leave it alone until it literally starts to cook the fat up out of the top. That's when you're going to turn it, and that's when having a good beveled, high-quality spatula will make your life easier on a well-seasoned griddle. Flip it over, finish it, melt cheese on it if you want to. That's it. There is nothing hard about this. The reason that people don't get success with smash burgers, their griddle's not hot enough, their griddle's too hot, their griddle's not well-seasoned. They are not patient. They flip it too soon. If you let it cook the way it's supposed to, again, think of it like making a pancake where you start to have the moisture bubble up out of it. It won't be exactly the same, but that is your procedure. And leave it. It should not take very long to finish when you flip it. You don't need to sear the other side. You just need to finish the cook. And so that's how you make a smash burger. And there's a lot of people, like, the only reason they even really want a flat top is to make smash burgers. I get it if that's your thing. It's really just a well-seared burger with good marketing. That's what it comes down to, though. Chicken thighs are one of my go-tos. That's why if you watch the video I did reviewing the Vivor griddle, that's why I cooked some. Chicken is something that I think we get nostalgic for things that look a certain way. So everybody loves the idea of the whole roast chicken for family dinner, right? Well, the chicken is not designed by its maker, right? The universe, God, whatever. The chicken architect of the universe. It was not designed to be cooked as a whole thing. You have dark meat, you have light meat. You have thick pieces, you have thin pieces. And even if you're taking it down to a piece like a thigh, which is dark meat, you have a thick side of the thigh, you have a thin side of the thigh. You have skin, you have a bone. You got to cook it all the way through to the bone. The best thing in the world to do with chicken thighs that you want to cook on the griddle is to bone them. And boning chicken thighs is so easy, I don't understand how anybody can't figure out how to do it. Lay the thigh down. Push on the meat on both sides of the bone to kind of expose where the bone is. Run your knife through the center of the bone, then on both sides of the bone, and then take the tip of the knife, go underneath, cut it out. That's it. On one side, you'll probably have like a gnarly piece of like gristling cartilage off of the bone. Cut that off. That's it. That stuff goes in a pile for making stock. Now you have a piece that will lay nice and flat. There may be some parts of it are a little thicker than others, but overall it's fairly uniform. It'll cook beautifully for you. You can cook it skin on. You can cook it skin off. That's up to you. I love chicken skin. I still usually cook them skin off. Why? Because I cook the skin separately. And I can cook the skin until it's like cracker crisp that way. If I'm cooking it to eat now, I cook it all the way through. If I'm cooking it to save it for other uses, I cook it till it's almost done. Then I can put it in a plastic bag, throw it in the refrigerator. I can bring it out and finish it in the oven, in a frying pan, on a grill, whatever. And they're great to add to things. So, like, I could be doing a salad and take some chicken skin like that, crisp it up, take a knife and cut it into slivers and put that over a salad. Yeah? I almost never cook my chicken skin on my grill. Not because it doesn't do a good job, because I'm a resource guy. If I buy a thing, I want to extract all the resources from it. Chicken fat is one of the best cooking fats on the planet. Like, I love cooking with beef tallow, but try cooking a steak in chicken fat. It's crazy how good it is. So I cook my chicken skin in a frying pan in the house. I pull the skin out, and then I strain the fat into a ball jar. And I label all, I have all different animal fats, all of God's creatures I render fat from. And I put them in my refrigerator, and I use them for various different cooking things. So now I got fat, and I got skin. And I have the trimmings. I take the trimmings after I'm done cooking the chicken fat, and I've strained it out, and there's a little bit of fat left in the pan. I throw the bones and all the pieces in the pan, and I brown it. If I have enough to make stock, then I throw that into a stock pot with vegetables and herbs, and I'll make a stock. If I don't, once it's browned, because I might as well do it while it's there, I'll throw it in a bag, throw it in the freezer, labeled. And sooner or later, I'll have enough browned bits of chicken to make a really good batch of chicken stock. So I get all those out of it. All this leading up to how do we cook that chicken on that griddle and make it perfect. Salt, pepper, garlic, that's it. Get it nice and dry. put the salt on first. Set it on your cooling rack. Stick it in the refrigerator. Leave it there for at least an hour or two overnight is fine. Put it at the bottom of the refrigerator so you reduce the risk of cross-contamination of pathogens. Lowest point in the refrigerator is the coldest, and there's nothing for it to drip onto. Simply set this in one of those pans, and any dripping goes in the pan anyway. Yeah? Leave it exposed to the air. It will get dry and tacky. Yes? Okay. So then the next thing we're going to do is when we're ready to cook it, a little extra salt on it for that outside salt because we got inside salt, pepper, and garlic. Cook it. That's it. Every time I make it doesn't matter if it's on the flat top. It doesn't matter if it's on the grill. It doesn't matter if it's in a pan on my stove. Every time I make it, my wife, same thing. How do you do this? And it's, again, the reason people struggle is they make things that are simple complicated. Making simple things complicated is how you try to hide inadequacies. Chicken thighs are delicious meat. You don't need to hide anything. Cook it like that. Put it on the griddle. Put it with the smooth side, the non-roughed up cooked side down, because it takes longer for that side to brown than the roughed up side. Let it cook till that thing is almost done, and then flip it to finish it. And if you watch my video of the Vor griddle and you look at the sear that I'm able to get on a chicken thigh by just doing that, it'll blow you away. What I love about this, I usually would not make this as part of like a multi-thing, though it would be just fine, so I don't know why I don't, but I wouldn't usually do it for like, I have friends coming over, we're going to have like four or five courses, right? I usually wouldn't do chicken thighs in there. What I'll do is I'll get 20, 30 chicken thighs in one go. That way I have lots of stock, lots of skin, lots of fat. And I'll cook them, and we're good for like a week or two. Or we might even take half of them, vacuum seal, and throw them in the freezer. And then we're going to have a salad. You pull out a couple pieces of chicken thigh meat, cold. Slice it up, throw it on the salad. You want to make tacos, chop it up, throw it in the pan to warm it through, hit it with a little chili powder and some Mexican spice mix. Right? No matter what you want to do, it's there. And I have found that one of the easiest ways for me to stay on my diet and keep looking like this instead of the way I used to look is to have the food that I'm allowed to eat available. So when I want a snack, I open the refrigerator, there's a Tupperware in there with 12 chicken thighs in it. I'll grab one, stick it in my mouth, you know, and walk back to my office and eat that. So what's your snack? Chicken, right? And if you don't really want to eat things like that, you're probably not hungry. You're just bored, and that's why you're eating. So that's chicken thighs. Jumbo scallops. I talked about using a little scallops in the thing I made for my wife, but scallops are one of the most delicious things on God's earth. If you make them right, if you overcook a scallop, you have sinned against the sea. And that those big ones, that's a pretty old shellfish. He spent a lot of years growing himself into that for you, and you ruined it. And you should be beaten with a frozen trout for sinning against this, a frozen salmon, an ocean run salmon. You should be beaten with a big one too, like two hander for sinning against the sea and destroying a scallop. There is this school of thought. Sometimes you get scallops, they have that little side piece of muscle on and people pull it off. Don't pull that off. It tastes the same. It really does. For those that don't know, though, if you've ever eaten like an oyster, a clam, a mussel, and when you open it up, you have like this big boogery part that's the part you really want to eat. And when you pull it out, sometimes there's a little round piece that's it's the abductor muscle that stays stuck to the shell, right? That's all the scallop is. So when you get a scallop that's like 2 inches in diameter, it was huge. And they threw away. And by the way, I'm opposed to that, too. That's actually really great, high-quality food, honestly. Some of the canned scallops that you can get, like become like sardine cans, they have the whole part, and they're freaking delicious. Certainly, you could do like a chowder or something like that with them. But I don't know where they go, what they do. They just throw them away or whatever. But you only have that abductor muscle. So it's going to get redundant, right? Salt, pepper, garlic powder. Brush them with a little bit of oil on all sides first, then coat them with salt, pepper, and garlic. Get your griddle at about 350 to 380 degrees, somewhere in that range. Put them down on the flat side and don't touch them. What people do is they put something down like that. You've got a good slick surface on your griddle. You've got a good seasoning, and you think stuff doesn't stick. A lot of things will stick initially, and as they cook, they'll begin to release. So when you're ready to turn it, and you know you probably want it about halfway cooked when you turn it, and you go to pick it up with your tongs, take your time. If it's sticking, give it a second and see if it unsticks. If not, go under it with your spatula. Don't pull on it. You'll pull it apart. Flip it over. Cook it till the other side has color on it. That's it. That's it. If it's undercooked, cook it longer. Once you get dialed in on scallops, that's all you'll ever have to do. Bacon wrap scallops, they're cool for cocktail parties and shit like that. If you want bacon with your scallops, cook the bacon separately. If you want to get that sear, you want to get that scallop perfectly cooked, it doesn't take long. Remember, you can eat them raw, so you're not going to hurt yourself if they're a little bit underdone. But if they're overdone, they suck. And you've sinned against the sea, and you've wasted a lot of money. All right? Next, how about cauliflower rice that doesn't taste and smell like cauliflower stink? Right? Now, a lot of this stuff is delicious with rice. Good chicken thigh, some sautéed vegetables, rice. I don't eat a lot of rice. And if I'm going to cheat and eat carbs, I'm going to eat something other than rice. So we use cauliflower rice a lot. We go to Costco. We buy these bags. It's four bags inside one bag. And each little bag is about a perfect serving for two people. And it says to microwave it. If you microwave it, you will take it out of the microwave and you will throw it outside in the garbage, not inside in the garbage. And then you will fumigate your house. You will open all your windows. You will put a fan blowing out one window and in another to get a cross breeze. And you will spend a good 20 minutes to de-stink your house while you run around spraying it with free breeze because it stinks that horribly if you microwave it. So don't do that. Cut the bag open. Dump it in a colander. Throw it in the sink. Let it defrost. 80% of the moisture will drain. It's when you freeze cauliflower, it fills itself with water. Most of the water will drain out. Press down a little bit. Once it's fully defrosted and drained, you'll push more water out of it. Yeah. Throw about a quarter stick of butter where you're going to cook it on your griddle and melt the butter down and throw it on there and fry the shit out of it. Salt and pepper, that's it. That's all you got to do. If you do that with cauliflower rice, when you start adding like any kind of flavors, sauces, whatever, it'll absorb those. It'll taste like anything you make it with. You've got to get the moisture out of it. You got to cook it hard. If you don't do those two things, it will stink. Cauliflower stink to high heaven. So that's how you do that. If you want to fry rice, there's plenty of instructions on how to do that. The reason I give you that, I guess you could maybe make the cream sauce on a griddle because you pretty much can do anything, but it's probably not worth doing. I make a garlic cream sauce, garlic onion cream sauce, that is unbelievable, and anybody that tried it would swear there's butter in it, but there's not. It's made with cream, chicken stock, onions, and garlic, and some other things. I'm not going to go through how to make it today because it's a very visual thing, but I have a write-up that includes the full recipe to make this garlic cream sauce, and that isn't going to be in today's show notes for you today. But you make that cream sauce, and whenever I make it, I'll make like a double or even a quadruple batch of it, and I'll break it up, and I will freeze it so that I can take it out and cook with it in the future. If you only make a single batch, it's very quick to make. As you scale your batches up, it takes longer. It is a multi-staged reduction because you're going to add things in stages. So we're going to add the chicken stock and wine, and we're going to reduce that. Then we're going to add the cream, and then we're going to reduce that. And the amount of onion and all that you have to saute to translucent goes up, and the time it takes to make it goes up. So I generally don't go more than a quad batch. But if I wanted to make it just for today, I can make a single batch in about 15 minutes. It's not that long if you're making a single batch of it. But the reduction is very, very important. Let's say you have this cream sauce. One of the best things I ever made on the griddle, the time on the griddle was very, very brief. I made some of the cauliflower rice for people that swore they would not like cauliflower rice. I took a package of pre-cooked, shelled crawfish tails, dumped it on the griddle, hit it with a little bit of Old Bay, and tossed it around until it was warm through because it's already cooked. I mixed the cauliflower rice and the crawfish, dumped about half of what I planned on for total of the cream sauce onto it right on the griddle, cooked it in, pulled it off to a bowl, and then took the extra warm sauce, poured it over, and mixed that in. So it had a mix of additionally cooked and kind of caramelized a little bit sauce, plus the fresh sauce. The two people that were here destroyed that. They weren't in love. Well, one of them wasn't in love with the idea of crawfish. Neither one of them was in love with the idea of cauliflower rice. And they both said it's one of the best things I ever ate. Like, when you can get people to enjoy eating a thing that they normally wouldn't eat, you're doing something right. And I think a lot of things that people don't think they like, you just never had it cooked right. When I first met my wife, she was completely adamant she didn't want to eat deer meat. And I'm like, that's kind of weird because you eat cows, you eat lambs, you eat chickens, you know. She said, well, it's not the deer itself. It's the way that it tastes. And I'm like, well, what, pray tell, do you think venison tastes like? And I'm like, before she even answered, I said, but you're going to say liver. She goes, that's it. It tastes like liver. I'm like, okay. So whoever cooked it for you didn't know how to cook it. If you overcook venison, it tastes like liver. Don't do that. And there's so many things. And again, Mitchell says, I need to post the garlic cream sauce. It will be in the show notes, Mitchell. It's actually posted a long time ago. I covered how to make it on the air a long time ago. It will be there for you. There's a link in the show notes or the video notes below if you're on the video. If you click it right now while we're live, it won't go anywhere. We're not done yet. But about 30 minutes after we wrap this, the live stream up, you'll be able to get that recipe and everything else, all everything I've talked about. And there's tons of cool links down there you should check out as well. I lost my place now on that. Oh, yeah, just there's so many things that people say they don't like. If you had it made poorly, then you really need to think about trying it again. Try a thing for the first time. What makes a lot of sense is go to a really high-end restaurant. Spend the money. See what it's supposed to be like. And then if you want to make it yourself, you know what you're shooting for. And then when you fuck it up, you're like, oh, I did something wrong, not this thing itself sucks, right? And here's how you know when somebody doesn't know anything about cooking, when they use the phrase gamey. When people use it, like it has a gamey flavor. Where exactly are the gamey taste buds on my tongue, by the way, guys? Tell me. Those of you that like the term gamey, what does that mean? What gamey means is, I'm used to eating flavorless crap like white meat chicken from, Tyson that has no flavor, and there's flavor in this meat, and that weirds me out. Or somebody treated it poorly, cooked it like crap, processed it incorrectly, and there's a funky taste to it that shouldn't be there. And that's so gamey either means flavor at all, or it means somebody screwed it up. If I cook you a properly cooked piece of venison, you will think it's beef. You will. The only way you'll know is the grain's different, the color's a little different, and there's less fat. But overall, you'll be like, this is a piece of really lean, excellent beef. So it's all in the technique. And yes, you can bake biscuits, right? Now, I'm not going to talk about how to make biscuits from scratch. But like the biscuits that you buy in a can or in a bag that you put in your oven and you bake. I know a lot of you guys have big families. You're not all low-carb people like me. And biscuits with breakfast, let's just be honest, sausage, biscuit, gravy equals good. And you want to make biscuits like that, and you're like, well, if I'm going to cook bacon and sausage and eggs on the griddle, I guess I can fire the oven up. But what if you want to do everything outside? What if the whole family is going to sit on the back porch and eat? And back to this, guys. You just take your cooling rack. You set it on your griddle, good hot temperature on the griddle, about 400-ish degrees service temperature is a good temperature to do this because you're going to lose some heat, right? Set those prefabricated biscuits on this thing. Take your basting dome, stick it over there, and keep an eye on them. You can also, I've seen people do it, throw the biscuits right on the griddle, lower temperature if you do that. They come out pretty good. You're usually going to get a little bit of like a burn to the outside, though, and not quite as like nice of a bake. But you can make biscuits on a griddle. You can make just about any. You can make French fries on a griddle. Not home fries, French fries on a griddle. Anyway, moving on. I want to go fast here as we wrap up because we're at, an hour and 30 minutes, and I did 2 hours with John and Nicole. So I'm 3.5 hours of live stream so far right now at this minute. But some techniques, hacks, and concepts that will get you overall better results. Number one, you need to prep like a chef for this. Large volumes of food over time is what you're doing, which is what a chef does. You order a thing, the chef makes a thing. The next guy orders a thing, the chef makes a thing. Table of 12 comes in, they all order something different. All the chefs are back there cooking shit all the time. What you don't see in a restaurant is, you know, Julio, who comes in at 4 o'clock in the morning when it's a lunch restaurant that doesn't open until 11:30 and makes just stock. Julio comes in and makes stock and sausage. And Bill comes in and Bill preps veg. The restaurant manager, the sous chef, whoever's in charge of that, looks at their historical use and says, we need X pounds of tomatoes diced. We need this, that, that. And so there's all this prep work done. So when Tom, who's actually manning the stove, gets your order and it's a steak with a, you know, haricot vert, which is green beans and bacon, I guess. Like everything's ready. And then like a little side of carrots and he needs some garlic and all. It's all ready. It's all ready to go. And so when you are getting ready to do something like this, whether it's just for your family or a group coming over, whatever, game out the whole thing. What am I cooking? What are all the ingredients and everything I need to do this? What is everything I can do before I even take it out the door? Cutting boards, bowls, whatever, everything ready to go. So that when you start cooking, you can cook and you can sit down with your family or your guests and you can eat. And if you do that, it's amazing how easy this is. And so what the interesting thing, though, is you become Julio and Bill in the morning doing all the prep work. So your guests come over and go, wow, look at him go. The guy cooked a 5-course meal. Looked like he never barely broke a sweat. The only reason he sweat is because he was over top of the hot griddle. Well, they don't see all the work that goes in before it. Right. So, but do that prep work, even if it's just a few things you're cooking. Like you're just doing burgers. And if you're doing burgers with buns, right, and you're going to have sliced tomato, and get everything ready before you start cooking. And it'll just make your life easier. That's true in anything you're cooking, but especially outdoor kind of griddle grill cooking, right? Next, you should separate your veggies based on cooking time. Let's say that I wanted to make a side dish to go with a steak. And for that side dish, I was going to do carrots, snow peas, and asparagus. That sounds freaking good. It's a mixed vegetable. Okay, the carrots need to cook the longest. The peas and asparagus probably close to the same amount of time. But one may get done a little bit before the other. So what I'm going to do with that, I'm going to have them separated into three different piles, three different bowls, whatever. I'm going to go down with the carrots. When the carrots are almost done, I'm going to go down with the asparagus and the peas. As soon as the carrots are done, they're going to come off and go into a serving dish. And then as the asparagus and peas finish, they're going to come off and go into the serving dish. It's amazing to me people don't do this. You see people take a bowl of mixed vegetables, and it's mushrooms, carrots, snow peas, and let's say green beans. There are dramatic differences in the cooking time for each one of those things, depending on their size, their shape, etc. So I can't tell you what order to do everything in. You have to kind of work that out for yourself. But as you work out, it takes this a little bit longer than that. Separate your cooking times, even if you're going to combine everything back together. That will make your life easier. Clean as you go. So if I'm cooking and I'm, you know, you got your zones on your griddle and I move burgers over or steaks over and they have that residue sticky shit, I take my scraper, right? I take my scraper and I scrape that spot right away, instantly, right? And if I want to cook there again, go down a little oil or grease or whatever and then move back into it. If you do that, your final cleanup at the end will be much better and you'll have a lot less clumpy, sticky, nasty shit sticking to everything. Clean as you go. When you are done, hit the damn griddle, kill it, hit it with water immediately, take your scraper, push everything into the grease trap. That will take you 1 minute at most to do. I mean, even the stickiest, nastiest stuff you cook, if you get some barbecue sauce in there, if you do it instantly and you have a good seasoned griddle and you've been using it for a while, it should come off. There might be some more cleanup to do. Now you can sit down and have your meal. If you're in the middle of courses, the griddle's plenty clean enough to turn the heat back up and do it again. A lot of times when I am doing that multi-stage thing, I turn half the griddle off and the other half, I'll turn both burners to as low a setting as possible, depending on how long it's going to be before my next course. you can manage that yourself. If you have an electric griddle, just bring your temperature way down, but don't go all the way to cold. So you keep some heat, so it's less time to get back to cooking temperature in the next next course. But if you clean as you go and clean it, and when you get to the end and you want to sit down and eat with your guests, you don't have to make the griddle perfect, but get it cleaned off. Because if you don't, it will be much more work later. What you should have to do at the end of the day, everybody goes home, turn the heat back on, give it a good one more good scraping, heat it up, hit it with water, then give it a coating of oil or grease. And what a lot of people say is turn it off and give it a light coating and don't worry about burning off that oil. Just leave it there. It's a protective coat. I always go ahead, since I'm doing it anyway, it gives me another chance to get another seasoning layer down on it. So I'll run it until it starts to smoke a bit. Then I will kill the heat, shut her down, and as soon as it's safe to do, that metal cover goes on the griddle. Every time I say, I'll do it tomorrow, it rains. It's almost like if I want it to rain, that's all I have to do, and it's going to rain, and it's just no good, right? Mise en place is a thing. That's having everything in place, a place for everything and everything that's placed before you start. Use high-quality fats. No canola oils, right? No vegetable oil. No Crisco. None of that shit. If you don't share my aversion to seed oils from a health standpoint, they have no place on a griddle. They have no place on a griddle because their smoke point's too low. This is high temperature cooking. Lard, chicken fat, those are kind of, and tallow are my three go-tos. I do occasionally use olive oil. Now you're going, wait a minute, Jack. Olive oil has a pretty low smoke point, but I'll tell you how I use olive oil. I use olive oil as a finishing oil. So I'm about to bring the thing off. I want to put a little bit more heat through it. I want to flavor it, what have you. I have a little olive oil, like Evo decanter. I'll just kind of maybe go across it with a little bit of that, and it's more of a finish thing. It's not on that high temperature griddle for very long. I cook primarily, again, beef tallow, bacon grease, pork fat, chicken fat, duck fat. All of God's creatures that have fat get rendered for fat. I'll just put it that way yet again. I also say when you're spending time to consider that course level cooking, it is so much fun. It is so much fun to make a thing, to sit down, to eat with everybody, to have fun, to have discussion, have a drink, then go make another batch. And bring it back, and another batch, and bring it back. I think this makes so much more sense than let's cook 15 things and put it all down on the table like it's Thanksgiving all the time. Now, if you don't have the time, that's different. But if you have a leisurely weekend cook, cook it in batches. And not only will you get a better social experience, you get a better food quality experience. Because when you're making the scallops, you're making the scallops. So if you want to use Servantur, make the scallops. Sort of the scallops, then make the steak and finish with the steak, right? And let people take the individual foods in individual, right? I'm not saying never include a side or anything. I'm just saying stage out the meal. You'll get a better experience. It'll be easier on you as the cook, and you'll get the social components that go with it. I think you'll really enjoy it if you give it a shot if you've never done it. Always empty your grease trap when you're done. When you're done cooking, empty your grease trap. Now, you're cooking a multi-stage meal, and you look in the grease trap, and it's not that full, okay. When you finish for the day, empty the grease trap. If you're cooking a lot of food, keep an eye on the grease trap, and you really want to do that because some griddles, you kind of have to push the grease. A lot of griddles, the grease just kind of runs. And so when you take the grease trap off and you're still cooking, grease is dripping like onto your patio or whatever. So kind of in the interim is where you want to do that. But what you're trying to do is avoid something I call Schrodinger's grease trap. So for the non-scientifically minded, Schrodinger was this scientist. He came up with this concept. If you take a cat and a vial of poison, and the vial of poison has something that can cause it to break at any given time, and you put them both in a box together, and you close the box, the cat can be thought of as both dead and alive. And you don't know which one it is until you open the box. It's an uncertainty principle, basically. And you're certain that one of two things is true, right? But you don't know which one it is. Schrodinger's grease trap is where you've let the grease trap fill, and it hasn't overflowed yet.
But literally any movement is going to cause it to overflow, and now you must take it out. And especially like the hookover ones, like on the back of a Blackstone, there ain't no level. It's gonna spill, and it's a mess. So always, like I said, you have a shutdown procedure, and emptying the grease trap is part of it. Let's say you broke the rule, but you didn't make Schrodinger's grease trap. You go to fire the griddle up, and you remember that you were a bad boy, and you didn't enter your grease trap. And you look in your grease trap, it's like three quarters full, and you're like, I really don't want any more grease in there. But the grease is a solid brick of grease. What do? Take the grease trap out, set it on top of your griddle, and start your warm-up. Let the heat transfer from the griddle into the grease trap, and it will melt the outside first, and then you can dump the big lump of grease out without digging into it with a spoon or some kind of crap like that. You're asking me how I know. And then, I'm not going to go deep into this, but I have a video out on my channel that you can look up. Just go to my channel on YouTube, and I have these wooden tray extenders that I built for my Blackstone. Those are fantastic. They're just built out of fence wood. They give you more surface area, and they're a porous wood, so when you set the greasy spatula down, the wood sucks the grease up. You clean them, you know, once every couple of weeks, just spray them with some cleaner and hose them off, hit them with a hard bristle brush. They don't look the greatest in the world, but they make more surface area to put stuff on, and you don't end up with grease transferring to grease, transferring to grease, transferring to grease. Because the metal shelves on a Blackstone, you set down a spatula, and it's just nasty. And since I did this, my life's better, right? And then spiral sausage slice, which I was asked about here. Who is that, James? Yeah, Jesse. What do you mean by spine slice? It's spiral slice is what I meant to say. And I won't doubt that I said it spine because it's been a long day already. But this is a technique done a lot with hot dogs and stuff like that. Sometimes people do it with a skewer as well to keep the thing straight. And it does work with hot dogs. What it is we create a spiral slice around a hot dog or a sausage. And there's two schools of thought. One is you go really, really deep, and it makes this kind of accordion-looking thing. What I like to do is just score the skin of the dog or the sausage. And this will work best with a sausage that's like a pre-cooked sausage that you're just going to brown and serve. So like a raw bratwurst, it probably won't work very good with, because that's the skin is so thin and the meat's not firm yet. It's just going to kind of explode on you. But any kind of like a smoked sausage, a pre-cooked sausage where it's already fully cooked, you take a knife, good sharp knife, and you lay it on an angle on the sausage. You start turning it and you make a spiral all the way up the length of the sausage. So it goes around and around. And when you cook it, it will kind of pop open and all that rough surface gets nice and brown. And if you kind of baste it with any kind of sauce or anything, like a bratwurst done with like a porter or a stout, thickened stout sauce, into that is just freaking phenomenal. And if you are a bread person, this is where I discovered this in the first place. I used to do it with just vertical slices, then I discovered the spiral and it looked cooler, so I do that now. When you put it on a bun and you go to bite it, if you've ever bitten into like a bratwurst or something and it like pops in your face and grease at you, or it wants to pull off the bun, since it's got those slices, it just eats nicer. But it also takes flavor so beautifully if you do that. It's really, really a simple thing to do. So anyway, this went kind of long. I knew it would, because we had a lot to cover. Thank you for hanging with me. I just want to really encourage you to think about adding this to your life. And if not, then think about using these techniques. Like the recipe I gave you for the clams, the mussels, and the sausage, you can do that in a pan on your stovetop. You can do that in a pan sitting on a grill. And like I said, you can get very creative with that. You can go kind of toward a cioppino type of thing with that. You can go toward like a bouillabaisse with that. You can do anything that you want with that. You can have a lot of fun playing with just that recipe alone. And there's something about the wine, the butter, and the cream together with the flavor from, again, like a good andouille sausage or a good chorizo sausage. Those flavors just marry in that. And again, like a bias sliced green onion on top of that to finish. Ugh. And by God, guys, that you have access to fresh herbs. except for things like rosemary that can kind of get caught in your throat, right, if they're just fresh on top because they're needles. Even if you cook with herbs, finish with the fresh herbs. Like right on the top at the end or just lightly cooked in, because the herbs do different things when they're used differently, right? They have a different way that they hit you, the fresh versus the cooked in that final food product. And just think about like how much value there is in being able to do these things for yourself at home versus what these things cost if we go out to eat. I like going out to eat. As much as I love to cook, I like having days where I take my wife out and we just chill. And I mean, I'm always the one that cooks because it's a passion of mine and I like it. But there is times when I want to be not the one that cooks. I just want to chill. And so that's great, but it's expensive. And for instance, 2 weeks ago, I had my grandson and my son over. My wife was doing a bridal shower for my niece. And that meant that my daughter-in-law was with them. And so I had my son and myself. I brought them over. I did something very similar to that clams and mussel thing, a little bit different. But it was mostly just mussels and some shrimps. And I did that. I did some lobster tails. They weren't in that. They were cooked separately. And I did some of the jumbo scallops exactly the way I said to you. It was like a 5-course thing. I did a bruschetta open for because my son loves bruschetta and his family doesn't eat it. So he doesn't ever get it, at least not fresh like that. And we sat there for about 3 hours together. And I looked at it and I said, if we would have went to a restaurant and ordered all these things, this would have been a $500 table. I had about $120 into it. That was with making a couple margaritas, by the way, right? This would have been a $500. And you wouldn't have got as much food. Instead of everybody getting 4 jumbo scallops, everybody would have got 2. Instead of everybody getting 2 lobster tails, you would have got 1, right? Instead of everybody eating mussels until they couldn't move, you would have got like 5. And by the way, a bag of mussels at Albertsons was $4.99, a whole bag of them. And the only reason I bought one bag, they didn't have 2. So when I do shows like this, sometimes I get from when I get the purists, I guess, in the audience. How's this a survival topic? You're talking about being all chef and you're making clam and mussel and sausage with wine, butter, and cream. I don't know. I think keeping more money in your pocket and having a better quality of life is a survival topic in 2024. I think being able to keep more money in your pocket, period, is a survival topic. When I had people on, actually, I'm going to have somebody, I think from next week, I'm going to have somebody on from Swan Bitcoin on. They said, well, find the person that's in the survival in Swan. I'm like, money is a survival topic. Just give me somebody that knows what you do. That's what I want, because money is a survival topic. Lifestyle design is a survival topic. That's what this is all about. With that, as we wrap up, let me remind you that you can always help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. Again, today I have a ton of the accessories I talked about in the write-up. If you want to pick any of that stuff up from Amazon or what have you, please use my links. If you're going to go buy it in the store, that's fine. I don't get upset about that. I'm not like, you have to buy for me. But if you're going to shop online, start at tspaz.com. I also have this relationship with Vore, and to me, it was a perfect day to bring the Vivor 21-inch commercial electric griddle back around. This little thing is awesome. It does take longer to heat up. My Blackstone, I turn it on, 10, outside 15 minutes I'm cooking. This is 20, 25 minutes to get to a good cooking temperature. But it's an incredibly thick cooking surface. The heat retention is amazing. And I actually have to say, from a pure ability to sear and keep the temperature high, it actually outperforms my Blackstone. My Blackstone is a $400 griddle. This is a $120 griddle. Because it's electric, you can use it inside or outside. And since it's portable, you can take it anywhere that you want to go. I have a great write-up on it, and I have a great video about it. If you read the write-up and you're like, but I want a gas griddle, I want a bigger griddle, Vivor has some pretty badass options in small gas griddles and in freestanding 36-inch griddles. Is it as good as a Blackstone? The honest answer is I have not ever tried one, so I don't know. But you can save about $160 buying the 36-inch gas Vivor. And from what I've seen from their electric one, I have no reason to doubt their ability to produce a high-quality griddle. And let's be honest. It's pretty hard to screw up a griddle. It's not that complex of a thing to build. So check this out. Again, today's item of the day, the 21-inch commercial electric griddle. And if you like to cook a lot of food, check out the warming box that I featured yesterday. That's also on the site and in the show notes. One more quick question here. Jesse says, chives, fresh basil, rosemary, spine sliced. Not sure where you're going there, Jesse, because the spine sliced is actually spiral sliced like I told you. And the spiral slices for sausage. I guess you mean could you take the fresh herbs and sprinkle it on the sausage once it's spiral sliced? Sure. If you want to clear that up before I close in the next couple seconds, please go ahead. Lori Ann says, got the vacuum sealer you recommend. Looking forward to using it and compare it to Food Saver, especially for wet items. There's no comparison. I still have like an old school Food Saver. We never use it anymore. We never use it anymore since we got a chamber vac. And one day I should do a show like this dedicated to hacks where what you can do with a chamber vacuum sealer. Because there's a lot of cool shit you can do with a chamber vacuum sealer. I'll throw you a little bonus chefy thing here at the end of the day. Because any chamber vac will do this. A Food Saver won't. Because if you put wet shit in a Food Saver, it sucks it out into the Food Saver, right? So we need a chamber vac to do this. It's called compressed fruit. And here's one I tried that was pretty spectacular. We diced up some watermelon. This was another back porch thing. We didn't make a lot of it. But we diced up, you know, a good dozen cubes of watermelon. We put it in a vacuum seal bag. We put one shot of Grand Gala, which is like Grand Marnier or Cointreau. By the way, you're making your margaritas. Grand Gala costs like a third less a bottle. It tastes exactly the same as those, right? So triple sec shit. Grand Gala is a 80 proof, awesome freaking orange liqueur. And so we put about a shot in there, and we vacuum sealed the watermelon. You don't have to use an alcoholic beverage. You don't have to use anything to do this. What happens is you pull all the moisture out of the fruit, and you compress it. And it's kind of crazy. The watermelon goes from this like pink color to this deep, dark ruby red. It almost looks like a candied red salmon, like a coho or something salmon, right? And then you can eat it right away, but I threw it in the refrigerator for a couple hours because I was waiting for my kid to come over. Oh, man. Totally different experience than a piece of watermelon. And I've seen it done with pears and all kinds of things. And all what it does, it makes the fruit more dense. And it eats a little bit differently, and it also intensifies the flavor and the sugar content because since there's less surface area, the juice, the sugars, et cetera, the flavor is more intense per bite. It's a pretty cool way to make a very simple dessert, serve chilled. You can do it with three or four different fruits. So if any of you guys would like me to maybe one day do a whole show just on hacks and things you can do with chamber vacs, let me know, and maybe I can put that together for you. With that, again, start your online shopping at tspaz.com. Prep to Adventure, thanks for the $4 super sticker. I will catch you guys tomorrow. We'll be doing an interview. I think I actually might have the Swan guys from Swan Bitcoin on tomorrow, but I'm not sure. I'll have to check with my wife on that. Take care, guys, but I will catch you with another live stream tomorrow. Just run you round. They said you should have a house. American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.